Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, May 11, 2015. International aid agencies warn that families living in Upper Nile State may suffer as rebels and government troops battle for control of areas.
If the conflict does move to Lae and the population have to run and hide in the swamps out of fear, then there will be critical humanitarian needs that are not being addressed.
And a senior rebel official says his group is not mistreating NGO personnel in South Sudan as alleged.
And I want to repeat, we can never be a problem to the UN agencies because our people, their livelihood is very difficult. They cannot make anything for themselves because of the war. They are relying mainly on the supplies that they get from the UN agencies.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A surge in fighting near the village of Lae in southern Unity State has sent thousands of people fleeing into the bush and forced aid organizations to evacuate staff. Medicine Sans Frontières, or MSF, and the International Committee for the Red Cross warned that the departure of aid workers from Lae means hundreds of thousands of people will not have access to the emergency assistance and medical care they urgently need. Mungume Debs Rakarinj reports from Juba.
MSF head of mission in South Sudan, Paul Krishle, says about 20 of the organization's international staff, including nurses, doctors and administrators, were evacuated from Lae on Saturday. MSF says medical activities at the hospital in Lae have been significantly scaled down amid fears that heavy fighting will reach the town. Krishle says MSF fears a repeat of what happened in Lae more than a year ago.
It was well recorded that January last year, the hospital was looted, parts of it were burnt, our operating theatre was destroyed, and with reports of the conflict getting closer to Lae, we had to move our international team out.
Last year, some 240 MSF staff who worked at a rare hospital fled into the bush, some carrying critically ill patients with them, as fighting closed in on the town. A month later, the medical staff were still in the bush, struggling to treat patients with rapidly dwindling supplies, MSF said on its website. MSF has run the hospital in Lae for 27 years. Krishle says in the month of March alone, nearly 8,000 people, including more than 1,000 malnourished children, sought treatment at the MSF facility. He says the surge in fighting in Unity State is putting a severe strain on the ability of organizations like MSF to help people in need.
Clearly, if international humanitarian actors do not feel secure to work in any area, the population that rely on them for food, emergency medical assistance, are at increased risk. Clearly, if children who are malnourished do not get therapeutic food, if families do not get food, if the conflict does move to Lae, and the population have to run and hide in the swamps out of fear, then there will be critical humanitarian needs that are not being addressed.
The International Committee for Red Cross, OICRC, also evacuated international staff members from Lae town this weekend. Lae is 93 miles south of the state capital, Bentiu. ICRC's South Sudan spokesman, Pavo Kshishek, says thousands of people have fled their homes in and around Lae because of the ongoing clashes. He says 20,000 families in the area depended on ICRC for food rations.
Should the fighting escalate, those people will move. They will move to more swampy areas. They will have very limited access to food. They will have very limited access to basic services, to clean water. So the situation of children who pregnant women who are particularly vulnerable in this kind of situation will certainly deteriorate.
The United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator, Toby Lanza, said in a statement today that the humanitarian response south of Bentiu has come to a halt. Lanza says the interruption of relief operations will affect more than 300,000 civilians in the area by cutting them off from life-saving assistance. Glacier says some of the urgently needed services that patients will be deprived of include HIV/AIDS care and treatment for Kalzal or Leishmaniasis. He warns that an interruption to medical care for some chronically ill patients could lead to even bigger problems for patients and aid workers.
Obviously, for patients with diseases like tuberculosis who require long-term medical care, regular medical care, any break in their treatment for an extended period can cause them harm, but it can also help, if the disease is not treated, can help generate multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis, which is much more difficult to treat.
Lanza says people have been fleeing from some villages near Rer since the beginning of May. He says the fighting in Unity State is not only hampering relief operations, but also preventing people from tending to their crops during South Sudan's short planting season. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
The South Sudan government says rebel forces, not the government, are to blame for international aid groups pulling out of Leer. Presidential spokesman Ateny Wek Ateny spoke with VOA's Peter Clodi this weekend.
The world should understand the type of the rebel we are fighting. The government has given concessions to ensure that peace comes back to South Sudan. But the rebel are the one now refusing to come to their senses. So the government understands that there is need to protect its citizens, and there is need for the people of South Sudan to have access to humanitarian aid and to be able to even go and cultivate. This is a cultivating season.
Now, the next round of peace talks will begin shortly, but there are worrying signs that nothing will change because these talks have been ongoing for a long time and there seem to be no breakthrough at all. Why should South Sudanese have any hope of reaching a peace deal and ending this conflict?
We hoped that the rebel will come to their senses, so that they don't come with more demand. The only thing that the government cannot do and will not do is negotiating itself out of power. This is what the rebel wanted to see. If the rebels, understand they rebelled simply because they wanted power sharing, the power sharing the government has actually agreed on, upon, and they should take it on that basis. We hope the new countries that are actually added into a negotiating table into mediation, are going to be, to make the two parties to break through, because the ICAT, as you know, the last time the peace actually failed simply because the rebel were demanding a lot more than what is actually needed.
Why wouldn't the government, for the sake of your people, just compromise despite what is going on? Why wouldn't you compromise to bring some peace?
Unless the government did compromise to negotiate itself out of power. Otherwise, this government has done enough. Anything that will be expected from a responsible government to do anywhere. So we have given the position of Prime Minister, the non-executive Prime Minister. We have also offered the position of Vice President. Even at the worst cases, we have given the position of the two equal status. Vice President, this is a proposal of the government. But the rebels wanted the government to accept negotiating itself out of power.
That's South Sudanese presidential spokesman, Ateny Wek Ateny, speaking with Peter Clodi about who is to blame for aid agencies pulling out of Leer in Unity State. Meanwhile, the head of humanitarian affairs for Riek Machar's SPLM in opposition movement is accusing the government of preventing aid agencies from delivering desperately needed assistance to thousands of South Sudanese in rebel-controlled areas. Hussein Marnyot says red tape in Juba is hampering the delivery of emergency aid to people in parts of Jonglei, Upper Nile and Unity States.
Our people are actually the most affected, and these are the victims. We can never deny services. We can never be hard on NGOs or the UN agencies that actually are giving services to our people, because we need them most. I don't think we can actually be the problem. We can never be the obstacle for any humanitarian operation. I believe there was nothing. It's just a little misunderstanding that was played up to the New York, to Washington, and this to discredit us. And it's very unfortunate.
How many areas are under your control in Upper Nile, in Jonglei, and in Unity State?
The Great Upper Nile, except maybe the main towns like Malakal, Bor, Bentiu, these are the major towns that are actually under the government. But most of the rural areas is under us in full.
How is the relationship with the NGOs in the other areas that you're mentioning?
Our relationship with the NGOs, including the UN agencies working in those areas, is perfect. It's only that in Pagak, which is like our headquarters, I don't know what's the problem with the NGOs and the UN agencies. They are actually targeting Pagak as to be a center for all these crises.
Let us talk about the humanitarian conditions in areas under your control. Weeks ago, the U.S. government donated additional $16 million to help the work of humanitarian agencies in South Sudan. And the European Union also pledged some money to, you know, avert a catastrophe in South Sudan. How is the condition of people under your control?
First of all, I want to say thank you to all those donors, the U.S. government and the European Union and others who are actually so kind, so generous, paying money towards the people who are vulnerable in South Sudan. Unfortunately, NGOs or the UN agencies that are going to our areas, whether by flights or by road convoys, sometimes they meet a lot of difficulties, a lot of challenges that the government is not allowing them to go. For instance, food does not actually go to the areas actually regularly because of some sabotage that we see from the government in Juba.
What do they do to prevent these NGOs from going to your areas?
There's a lot of bureaucracy. For instance, if an NGO want to take some supplies to the areas that are under the SPLM in opposition, you need permission from the national security, you need clearance from the humanitarian offices. A long bureaucracy that actually keep on taking long, and the people, you know, the suffering can never wait, and the people are suffering. There are a lot of roadblocks that actually they need to search the UN or NGOs convoys, and this is causing a lot of delays. And I want to repeat, we can never be a problem to the UN agencies because our people, their livelihood is very difficult. They cannot make anything for themselves because of the war. They are relying mainly on the supplies that they get from the UN agencies. Mm-hmm. Unlike the regime in Juba, see Salva Kiir, now with the fourth anniversary of South Sudan independence, putting millions of pounds or dollars just to mark the Independence Day. And when next door to him, Juba Hospital is suffering, the children do not get even oxygen, do not get fuel for the generators to have electricity. The UNMISS camps are suffering, the people are there. He would have given out this money for a good cause to say, well, as people are suffering in South Sudan, we give this money to the UNMISS camps, those who are in the UNMISS camps or in the hospitals and all this. Just marking the day, squandering all that money when the country is dying, is going down economically, is very unfortunate.
That's Hussein Marnyot, the SPLM in opposition chairman for humanitarian affairs. He was speaking with me in our studio in Washington last week. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Governors of all 10 states meet with President Kiir to talk about their economic and political challenges. That story is after this.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is worse, having expectations that are too low or having no expectations at all?
I think having no expectations, I think that is the worst thing. Because a normal person have to have some expectations in his or her life.
Having expectations that are too low is something that is not good, because you have to expect something in life. If you expect something in life, you prepare, you know what to do. When you wake up in the morning, you know where to start from.
I think both of them are terrible. Having low expectation is as terrible as having no expectations at all. I think whenever one sets up expectations, you're meant to set up high expectations. They are like targets and goals that one is meant to achieve.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir today met with the governors of all the 10 states, the administrators of the disputed Abyei region, and the recently formed Pibor administrative area. As Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba, the talks focused on political and economic problems in South Sudan and how to resolve them.
Mr. Kiir chaired the meeting, which lasted more than 5 hours. Eastern Equatoria State Governor Louis Lobong told the reporters afterwards that the two main issues that were discussed were
peace and the general political situation of the country. The governors also and the two Achiba demonstrators of ABA and Greater Pibor also gave a security briefing to the president on what is happening in their respective states and administrative areas.
Although he said peace was high on the agenda of the talks, Lobong did not mention the stalled peace process that regional bloc IGAD has been leading for South Sudan for the past 16 months. He also did not go into detail about how the governors and the president proposed to kickstart South Sudan's ailing economy. But Lobong says the governors, administrators and President Kiir did discuss the National Assembly's decision to extend the terms of all elected officials, including governors, by 3 years from July.
The issue has been referred to the law experts, particularly the Minister of Justice and the advisor to the president on legal affairs, to see and how those resolutions of the parliament can be harmonized with the state constitutions.
The meeting was the first between the president and the governors since last October. The inclusion in the meeting of the administrator of Abyei could raise the hackles of neighboring Sudan. Abyei is claimed by both Juba and Khartoum. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Leaders of South Sudan's ruling SPLM party are meeting in Pretoria, South Africa this week in efforts to implement the Arusha Agreement signed in January. The SPLM in opposition leaders and SPLM former detainees agreed with the Kiir administration to revoke decisions that led to internal party division and sparked the 17-month-old conflict. President Kiir, who is also the chairman of the SPLM, is obliged under the deal signed in Tanzania to reinstate sacked party officials. Philip Thornaleu has more for VOA from Juba.
Akwil Malinda Bangol, SPLM Secretary for Popular and Syndicated Organizations, says the meeting in Pretoria started on Sunday and is continuing today. Mali says SPLM leaders who were detained at the start of the conflict in December 2013 and freed after 4 months of detention, are being asked to return to Juba.
This is a follow-up from Arusha agreement, and our people are discussing with the former detainees. We are asking them to join the rank and file of the party.
That agreement, mediated by Tanzania's ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi, or CCM, and South Africa's ANC party, requires President Kiir to revoke decisions made on behalf of the SPLM prior to the conflict. President Kiir later said the word revocation was replaced with the word reconsideration before the signing ceremony. But the National Liberation Council, the lawmaking body of the SPLM, had already passed the agreement with the original language. Last month, SPLM Political Bureau, the highest decision-making body of the ruling SPLM party, agreed to drop all criminal charges against former detainees led by Pagana Amom, the SAC Secretary General of the SPLM. Amom has yet to be reinstated to his position.
We can put conditions. Reinstating Pagana is not the responsibility of the president because he was not dismissed by the president. He was dismissed by the Liberation Council, but they have to discuss and they agreed. Whatever they may make recommendation, it might be good.
Mali says President Kiir has instructed the SPLM Constitutional Review Committee to prepare an amendment as required by the Arusha Reunification Agreement. He says President Kiir also offered amnesty to all armed and non-armed opposition groups to his government as a show of goodwill and commitment to the agreement. He says he wants the former detainees and rebel leaders to attend the South Africa meeting.
I'm praying and I'm urging them to come. They are coming. If they are convinced are revolutionaries, are the nationalists, they can decide to come alone by themselves.
Mali says the return of SPLM in opposition leaders, led by former Vice President Riek Machar, will require a permanent peace agreement to be signed. But he insists that both SPLM in opposition and former detainees are, quote, former colleagues and will always be welcome to Juba without fears for their safety, end quote.
If they think they are not secure here in Juba, and they are secure in Pretoria, they can bring whatever security they want to bring.
Mali says there are no details to OPA on the progress of the talks in Victoria, since the meeting only started yesterday. The SPLM in opposition and former detainees could not be reached for comment on this story. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Juba.
Turning to Cameroon now, aid agencies say Nigerian refugees give birth to 45 children every month at the Minawa refugee camp. Most of the children do not have official birth certificates. Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Minawa refugee camp in northern Nigeria.
Isaac Luka, leader of the group of Nigerian refugees at the Minawawo refugee camp in northern Cameroon, expressed gratitude to aid agencies for helping to establish birth certificates for their newborn babies.
We are very grateful because our children will benefit their civic rights. We thank the government of Cameroon and the head of the refugee partners, IADHCR, and the different UN agencies, without neglecting non-governmental organizations and the Cameroonian government, to the attention they reserve for us.
Theophile Gea-Beina, the highest Cameroon government official in the area, says the Nigerian children started enjoying their rights to birth registration following negotiations between the government of Cameroon and the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR.
Legally, the right of all children to have a birth certificate or a legal existence have been respected. Socially, these children are not responsible of what happened in their country. They are vulnerable, and the government of the Republic cannot stay and see this situation per se.
Gerasim Bouarem, UNHCR's associate reporting officer, says the birth registration does not confer Cameroonian nationality upon the refugee children. But he says by establishing a legal record on where a refugee was born and who their parents are, the kids can claim their Nigerian nationality when they become adults.
Where a child is born, he has the right to receive a birth certificate, which is not...
He says wherever children are born, they have the right to be issued birth certificates, but if they are born in a country different from that of their parents, they have up to 18 years when they become adults to decide to be nationals of that country if the constitution of the country allows him to have the nationality based on the fact that he was born there. Ombaneme Kaniset, a midwife at the refugee camp, says they prepare a birth declaration card for each newborn baby and forward it to UNHCR officials, working in collaboration with other aid agencies and the government of Cameroon. She says an average of 45 babies are born each month.
Il y a des femmes qui arrivent effectivement qui sont déjà enceintes. Pour celles qu'on constate que le psychique est atteint.
She says they direct some of the pregnant women who arrive at the refugee camp from Nigeria with emergency cases to specialists and then encourage them to follow up their prenatal consultation. She adds that some of them have never had prenatal care and most of them do not have medical records since they are running from violence. Some of the mothers do not know the importance of birth certificates. The UNHCR reports that since January this year, more than 11,500 Nigerians have arrived in the camp. The government of Cameroon says it has counted over 74,000 Nigerian refugees in Cameroon, and a majority are women and children. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Minawao, Northern Cameroon.
If you are in Uganda, we've got a question for you. What is the least attractive quality for a potential first date? As a tourist in Myanmar, what is the worst way to meet a girl on the street? to answer these questions and others you may never have thought to ask, VOA's Heather Murdoch talked to an international dating culture reporter.
Matthew Stein, a Canadian journalist in Uganda, publishes datingcultures.com. Here are some of the titles of his past video reports.
There was street flirting in Yangon, Rwanda's wet and wild tradition, gay all the way in Bergen, Norway, on stage at a Ugandan sex show, and of course, sex-bushed.
In the sex-bushed videos, Stein asks people on the street questions about local dating customs, offering small cash prizes, about $4, to winners.
Third question for $10,000. What would make somebody unacceptable for a first date in Uganda? A, if they're poor, B, if they're ugly, or C, if they're a smoker.
In Uganda, apparently smoking is the least attractive quality in a first date, according to a local survey. But some shopkeepers in the video object, saying poverty is a much bigger problem than smoking when it comes to dating. In this video from Myanmar, Stein tries to meet women on the street.
We can do drink beer or coffee. Can we meet sometime and have a drink together?
No, sorry.
No? But even later? Like tonight or tomorrow? Weekend?
Yeah, sorry. No.
Sorry, you're not free?
Yes.
You're still free. I'd like to meet you.
Thank you.
He is turned away by young women, explaining they don't go out at night because their culture demands obedience to their parents, who wouldn't approve. Stein says his material uses humor and a universally held interest in romance to draw people's attention to related issues they otherwise may not think about.
If I were to publish a story about Ugandan politics, that would only appeal to so many people. But if I use dating, which is a more universal subject, I think more people will watch, and in the process, they'll be exposed to other issues in that country that they wouldn't normally see in a 2-minute news report.
For example, other articles on his website about Uganda talk about abuses towards gay and transgendered people and women's rights. Dating Cultures videos have been filmed in roughly a dozen countries on 4 continents. The project used to be called Erotic Routes, a name creators recently abandoned because of complaints that it could make people think of pornography rather than cultural exploration. Stein says talking about sex or romance publicly in many of the countries he works in is often considered taboo. In his opinion, it shouldn't be.
I think it's a very important thing to talk about in countries where people are not able to talk about sex and their sex life. There's a whole bunch of problems that manifest itself, from STDs to teenage pregnancies.
And while these are serious consequences, he and his team hope to chip away at these taboos with jokes. Articles, videos, and international guides in the works also seek to encourage cross-cultural dating, Stein says, and prepare daters for what they may encounter as they travel the globe. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with Abdelmajid Koribera from Darfur singing in his native 4 language.
Baby, di dararwe, iarube dararwe, abarube dararo. Baby, di dararwe, iarube dararwe, abarube dararo.
We have been listening to Abdelmajid Koribera with that beautiful song from Darfur. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for taking your time to be with us. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.